Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to a morning of reflection, shared singing, and insight. We come here to be together, to remember ourselves in community, in connection. We come here because life needs to be celebrated, and because life is hard, full of struggles and fears. Today, we grapple with some of those fears. Following one of our UU forebears, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he who is not every day conquering some fear has not learned the secret of life. We may not uncover the secret of life, but we do come here to grapple with the mysteries and live life fully as we can. This morning, we welcome Don Huebner, longtime member of this congregation, to our pulpit. This morning's sermon is built off of a TED Talk she gave last year. Don, would you like to light the chalice? Good enough. Okay, we don't have to go home. Join in saying our covenant. Love is the doctrine of this church.
The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to see ecology and freedom, to serve humanity in fellowship, respect the nurturing power within all of us. Thus do we covenant.
We will now sing Here We Have Gathered. That's number 360.
Once, long ago, the Buddha was born as a little parrot. One day, a storm broke upon her forest home. Lightning flashed, thunder crashed, and a dead tree struck by lightning burst into flames. Sparks leapt on the wind, and soon the forest was ablaze. Terrified animals ran wildly in every direction, seeking safety from the flames and smoke. "Fire! Fire!" cried the little parrot. "Run! Run to the river!" Flapping her wings, she flung herself out into the fury of the storm and flew towards the safety of the river. As she flew, she could see that many animals were trapped, surrounded by the flames. A desperate idea, a way to save them, came to her. She darted to the river, dipped herself in the water, and flew back over the now raging fire. The heat was rising up from the burning forest, and it was heating like the heat of an oven. The thick smoke made breathing unbearable. A wall of flames shot up. Crackling flames leapt and danced before her. Twisting and turning through the fire, the little parrot flew on. At last, over the center of the forest, she shook her wings and released the few drops of water which clung to her feathers. The tiny drops... I'm realizing that I skipped that my printer printed this out of order. Why was she wet? and I know why she was wet. I said that. Oh, okay. Okay. I don't know. Well, I'm going to carry on this. Well, I don't think I read this part. Back and forth she flew, from the river to the forest, from the burning forest to the river. Her feathers were charred, her feet were scorched, her lungs ached, her eyes stung by smoke burned red as coals. Her mind spun as dizzily as the spinning sparks, but still the little parrot flew on. At this time, some of the devas, gods of the happy realm, were floating high overhead in their cloud palaces of ivory and gold. They happened to look down, and they saw the little parrot flying through the flames. They pointed at her with perfect hands. Between mouthfuls of honeyed foods, they exclaimed, "Look at that foolish bird! She's trying to put out a raging forest fire with a few sprinkles of water. How ridiculous! How absurd!" And they laughed. But one of those gods did not laugh. Strangely moved, he changed himself into a golden eagle and flew down, down towards the little parrot's fiery path. The little parrot was just nearing the flames again when the great eagle with eyes like molten gold appeared at her side. "Go back, little bird," said the eagle in a solemn and majestic voice. "Your task is hopeless. A few drops of water can't put out a forest fire. Cease now and save yourself before it's too late." But the parrot only continued to fly on through the smoke and flames. She could hear the great eagle flying above her as the heat grew fiercer, calling out, "Stop, foolish little parrot! Save yourself! Save yourself!" "I don't need a great shining eagle," coughed the little parrot, "to give me advice like that. My own mother, the dear bird, might have told me such things long ago. Advice! I don't need advice. I just need someone to help." And the god who was that great eagle, seeing the little parrot flying through the flames, suddenly thought of his own privileged kind. He could see them floating high up above. Yes, there they were, the carefree gods, still laughing and talking while many animals cried out in pain and fear from among the flames below. Seeing that, he grew ashamed, and a single desire was kindled in his heart. God though he was, he just wanted to be like that little brave parrot and to help. "I will help," he exclaimed, and flushed with these new feelings, he began to weep. Stream after stream of sparkling tears poured from his eyes. Wave upon wave, they washed down, a cooling rain upon the fire, upon the forest, upon the animals, and upon the little parrot herself. Where those tears fell, the flames died down and the smoke began to clear. The little parrot, washed and bright, rocketed about the sky, laughing for joy. "Now that's more like it," she exclaimed. The eagle's tears dripped from burned branches and soaked into the scorched earth. Where those tears glistened, new life pushed forth. Shoots, stems, and leaves. Buds unfurled and blossoms opened. Green grass pushed from among still glowing cinders. All the animals looked at one another in amazement. Washed by those tears, they were whole and well. Not one had been harmed. Up above, in the clear blue sky, they could see their friend, the little parrot, looping and soaring in delight. When hope was gone, somehow she had saved them. "Hooray," they cried. "Hooray for the brave little parrot and for this sudden miraculous rain."
Today's reading is by Brené Brown. She's a social psychologist internationally known for her work on vulnerability and shame. She begins her most recent book with the words of Teddy Roosevelt, spoken in 1910. Please broaden the quote as you hear it. He refers only to men, but I'm sure he meant women too. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, who at the best knows the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." Daring greatly It's the cornerstone of what Brown refers to as wholehearted living and the title of her newest book. In it, she says, vulnerability is not weakness, and the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure we face every day are not optional. Our only choice is a question of engagement. When we spend our lives waiting until we're perfect or bulletproof before we walk into the arena, we ultimately sacrifice relationships and opportunities that may not be recoverable. We squander our precious time and turn our back on our gifts, those unique contributions that only we can make. We must dare to show up and let ourselves be seen. This is vulnerability. This is daring greatly.
If you were brave and had a joy and sorrow, please come forward.
I have a joy today, which is that yesterday in Rye, New Hampshire, my son and I were on a road trip and we saw a snowy eagle on the roof of a house. And it was there the week before, I'm pretty sure. So if you go, you might see it.
And I saw an eagle yesterday as well. Well, I saw an eagle.
Wayne and I were gone for 6 weeks this winter. We went to Florida, we went to Venice, and we found a Unitarian Universalist church down there. We were thrilled to be able to find this church and enjoyed the people there. Always glad to be back, though. I did want to share that when we left, I put my mom in a six-week respite situation at the inn in Deerfield. Her name is Alice, and she came here for about a year with me. And she's so contented there that it's turned into a permanent residence for her. It's a beautiful spot. It's a memory care unit in Deerfield, New Hampshire. It's 32 beds. Feels like home. They have activities every day, and she's just out and about around the house, and it's a good setting for her. So although I've been grieving badly, it's the right thing for her. And I wanted to thank all of you for embracing her while she was here.
I know there are all of
I'll be brief.
Yes, fine. Don't be brief.
Or a sucker?
Don't be brief. Don't be brief.
Hi. I don't get up in front of the microphone very often because I might turn into a lounge singer, I've been told. But I did do a leap of faith or ignorance or a little bit of both, and I was a write-in candidate for supervisor of the checklist. Thank you to all 56 people that voted for me with my 24-hour zero-budget candidate run. And Susan Gorman is responsible partially for me being in that, as she also recruited me. And when I looked at the blank page, the line on the page, and there was no name written on it, it made me sad that nobody was stepping forward to help with a role. And I, you know, did one of those finger, somebody should do that. You know that thing about when you're pointing one finger, three fingers are pointing back at you? See? Okay. So, thank you for your support, whoever did or thought or sent energy, and I look forward to more support since now I'm actually going to have to do it. So, I might be recruiting. Thanks.
Is that a joy or a sorrow?
Yes.
So there's a life change. We know there are a lot of joys and sorrows in this room that are not spoken.
Today's meditation begins with the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, who says, fear keeps us focused on the past or worried about the future. If we can acknowledge our fear, we can realize that right now we are okay. Right now, today, we are still alive and our bodies are working marvelously. Our eyes can see the beautiful sky. our ears can hear the voices of loved ones. Let us sit together, filled by the beautiful sky. Daring greatly. It sounds so noble, doesn't it? So much like one of those qualities you admire from afar in the doers of deeds, the men and women in the arena. And yet, we're all in the arena. And the extent to which we show up, the extent to which we live our lives, meekly or wholeheartedly, well, that's really the question. Of course, sometimes the world conspires against us, or so it seems. We might be born into tough circumstances, in a family that cultivates shame, or with a brain primed for worry. I was born with one of those, which is why I have a confession to make. It scares me to be standing here. That might seem odd. Generally speaking, you are not a scary group. And I'm a psychologist. I know all about anxiety. I specialize in treating it, no less. You'd think I'd have the ability to stand in front of a perfectly nice group of people without feeling afraid, but I don't. And that's okay, because really, standing in front of you without feeling afraid isn't my goal. I've come to understand over the course of many years that managing anxiety has virtually nothing to do with making it go away. That in fact, the more you try to make it go away, the more stubbornly it sticks. It's like a Chinese finger trap, that woven tube you put your fingers into, and the more you pull against it, the more stuck you get. It took me a long time to figure that out. Like many people, I was an avid avoider of things that made me nervous, pulled against them with all my might. The last thing I wanted was to feel vulnerable. Roller coasters? Not for me. Lab sciences? No, thank you. Coffee hour? I don't think I attended once in my first 10 years at Fuse. I remember a service maybe a decade ago when we wrote down personal goals, put them into self-addressed envelopes to be mailed back the next year. I think we were invited to write three goals, things like be more patient with the people I love, or be mindful of my footprint on Earth. My goal? Go to coffee hour. Seriously. I think I even added once a month, you know, trying to be realistic, give myself some shot at success. But still, I hardly ever went. I hated that moment of standing in the doorway to the parish hall, seeing clusters of people, not knowing who to approach or what to say. That nervous uncertainty, such an uncomfortable feeling. It still makes me nervous just thinking about it. It makes sense to avoid uncomfortable feelings, so that's what I did. And when I had a child, I taught him to do the same. My son Eli also had a brain primed for worry. Some brains are just like that, exquisitely sensitive to potential danger. It's almost as if there are little antennae picking up on things that could go wrong, feeling the need to protect against them. Do you know anyone like that? People come by that style innocently, and then it gets reinforced. At least that's what we did, inadvertently. We reinforced Eli's fears. We helped him avoid all the things he was afraid of, implicitly agreeing that they were dangerous and beyond his ability to cope. It's easy to get hijacked by fear that way, to let it boot you out of the arena. You capitulate to it, and suddenly it's fear that's in charge. One of Eli's greatest fears was splinters. He got one once, and he was then terrified of rough wood, and then smooth wood, because there might be a rough part. It got to the point that he couldn't touch anything made of wood. And the more we reassured him and then accommodated his fear, the bigger it grew. One day when he was 10, we found ourselves at a mecca for splinters in upstate New York, an old wooden fort. We had planned for it, brought clothing that left no exposed skin, in effect agreeing that splinters were both likely and catastrophic. Because he was covered up, Eli was able to tromp around the fort, having a great time, until Jim and I plopped down on a bench to rest. A wooden bench. A wooden bench Eli, even in his long pants and long sleeve shirt, could not bring himself to sit on. Nor could he inch himself close enough to sit on one of our laps because he still might touch the bench. So he stood, rivers of sweat running down his face, utterly exhausted. It was a hot day, utterly defeated by his fears. He stood because there was nothing else he could do. He stood and he sobbed. I didn't know how to make Eli's fear go away. I was still under the impression that making the fear go away was the point, that if only I had a magic wand and could banish the fear, everything would be all right. I brought Eli to a therapist who listened to his list of fears and told us, look, he's 10 years old. He's afraid of splinters, shots, and bees, long, sharp objects that poke. Clearly, he had an underlying fear of penetration related to Oedipal issues. You heard that right, Oedipal, as in Freud. His wish to overthrow his father to have possession of me. I remember sitting there listening to this well-respected psychologist thinking, how can this possibly help us? And the answer was, it couldn't. So I went on a quest, determined to find a way to help my son. I landed on cognitive behavioral therapy, an approach to treatment based on the premise that we all have an inner triangle made up of our thoughts, our feelings, and our actions. The idea is that these are all interrelated, what we think, what we feel, what we do, each influencing the other. You can't just stop a feeling, but you can change it by changing the associated thoughts and actions. We decided to start paying attention to the action part of that triangle. Instead of helping Eli avoid the things he was afraid of, we would help him do them. It was definitely a better path, although I still didn't understand the bigger picture, that the glue holding all of this together was Eli's inability to tolerate uncertainty and fear. It wasn't the splinters, or the shots, or the bees per se. It was his relationship with his fear that was causing so much trouble. But I didn't know back then what I know now. I just wanted my kid to be able to go outside. So I did what any good parent would do. I bribed him. Just go outside, I said. You're not going to get stung. And if you do, I'll give you $10. Have you ever wished for one of those time machines? Nothing fancy, just some sort of gadget that allows you to pull back the stupid things you've said. First of all, how could I possibly know whether or not he'd get stung? I have no power over bees. And by promising him it wasn't going to happen, I was feeding right into his belief that a sting was this wholly unimaginable thing, that the only way he could dare step outside was if he had a guarantee against it. And then I turned around and offered him money, for the bad thing happening, a payout for the bad thing. If I had one of those time machines, here's what I'd say instead. It's not the bees that are making life hard, Eli. It's your fear. Your fear has become this giant bully, stopping you from doing all sorts of things. Let's figure out how to put you back in charge, you, instead of your fear. Of course, there is no time machine, and I didn't know then what I know now, so my focus was misplaced and my execution clumsy. But it worked. He did go outside. You know how this story is going to end. He got stung. Of course he got stung. He got stung within minutes of stepping outside. He handled the sting itself pretty well, which is typically how it goes. The possibility of a bad thing is often worse than the actual bad thing. The pain from the sting was real, no doubt about that, but it was relatively brief, and he saw that he could survive it. Plus, he got $30 out of the deal. Jim had promised him money, too. He went outside more willingly after that, and gradually, his fears abated. It wasn't the perfect cure. Although he did get over his fear of long, sharp objects that poke, enough to take up fencing, which was enough to show me that this was the right track, that managing fear was about learning to step towards rather than away from scary things. This way of thinking, this cognitive behavioral approach, transformed the way I worked with children anxious children who got better, so much better, that I decided to write a self-help book to bring these tools to a wider audience. My first book was for anxious kids, What to Do When You Worry Too Much, and it took off. I started being contacted by the national media and by professional groups and parenting groups wanting me to come speak. But oddly enough, I was never available. At least that's what I said. No matter what the invitation, when or where, I'm sorry, I just can't make it. I turned down public speaking invitations for 2 years. I was aware at some level of what I was doing. I knew I was afraid I would fall flat, get tongue-tied, not be interesting enough or funny enough. I had helped my child and hundreds of other children face their fears, and yet here I was, running away from mine. And the irony of it, me, a psychologist with a best-selling book about anxiety, a national expert on the treatment of anxiety. Anxiety, the very thing that was keeping me from standing up and talking about it. The hypocrisy alone finally spurred me into action. I was still seeing fear as something that needed to be done away with, a belief I've subsequently moved away from. But that's where I was at the time, and because of that thought-feeling-action triangle, I knew I needed to change what I was doing. So I reached for a technique, a good one, something called exposure. Exposure works through desensitization. You need to do the thing you're afraid of and do it again. And by doing and doing and doing, you get used to it. Exposure also works because when you do what you're afraid of, you begin to see that your nervous anticipation is often a false alarm. The feared outcome doesn't happen or isn't as bad as you anticipated. You begin to see fear as a signal system that's sometimes valid, but often goes awry. You see it as an emotion, temporary, like all emotions, something to be felt and assessed and managed, but not blindly obeyed. FDR told us that in 1932, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Again, so noble, but how's that translate into real life? It goes back to the understanding that it's not public speaking that was the problem for me, or splinters for Eli. It's not bees, or coffee hour, or heights, or fill in the blank with whatever you're afraid of. It's not these things in and of themselves that are a problem. It's our need to avoid the feelings they stir up, our desperate struggle to get away from our own feelings. That's what causes so much trouble. So the goal isn't to not feel afraid. The goal is to learn how to feel afraid, how to tolerate the fear without capitulating to it. You know, be guided by our faith and not our fear. I've been saying those words for 20 years, believing them, but somehow not living them. Not until recently. And it's the living of those words, in little ways and in big ways, that matters. So here's what I try to do now. Acknowledge I feel really vulnerable right now, and then just stay with it. Not try to push the feeling away or avoid the situation that's triggering it. Quite the opposite, actually. Whatever's triggering my fear, I want to find a way to step towards it. Of course, I'm not talking about truly dangerous things, things we all agree are harmful. I'm talking about the everyday fears that trip us up. Dogs, spiders, elevators, heights, public speaking, coffee hour. And the existential fears that make life difficult. The fear of change, loss, abandonment, failure. All those fears that don't serve us well. We can face those fears. We can learn the techniques. Desensitize, breathe, learn to talk to ourselves in a different way. We can plunge into feared situations, or we can enter slowly, mindfully, or with distractions. The point is to face the fear. The child of a colleague of mine had something to say about this. Her father's an eminent psychologist, a scientist practitioner who has spent decades meticulously studying and writing about the treatment of anxiety. His 7-year-old summed up his life's work and would have given a much shorter version of this sermon. Here's what she said. Blah, 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 whatever you're afraid of, do it. Blah, 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 then do it some more. Precisely. Fear is a feeling. It's not a soothsayer or a harbinger of doom. It's an opportunity, a beacon pointing us towards something that matters. Stepping past fear puts us into the arena, allowing us to live big, to dare greatly. Why wait another moment?
We take up an offering every week to support this community where we learn to be our best selves, where we find that larger spirit. There are candles available up front for those who wish to light one silently. The morning offering for all the ways we face our fears will now be received. I've just extinguished this little light of ours. Remember to bring it out into the world with you. Join me in the unison benediction. Go in peace.
Speak truth. Give thanks each day. Respect the earth and all creatures, for they are alive like you. Care for your body, it is a wondrous gift. Be gentle with yourself.